The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic. But before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, our journey begins in Texas, where we will learn more about the flight of the monarchs. This is written by Michelle Niehaus and appeared in the January 2024 issue of National Geographic. Now, we begin with a brief explanation by the editors, which goes, "Each year, these iconic butterflies undertake one of the most extraordinary and increasingly dangerous journeys on the planet. Now scientists and citizens are joining forces to help them." So let us learn more as we begin our article. On a hot, clear October day in Texas Hill Country, Andre Green II is gently shaving a monarch butterfly. Bent over his makeshift laboratory bench, he deftly pinches the butterfly's bright wings between a thumb and forefinger, swiping a sliver of sandpaper down its thorax to remove a few minuscule hairs. Green and his fellow researchers have set up temporary quarters inside one of the area's many private hunting lodges, and its walls are lined with the taxidermied heads of native and exotic game animals. But Green, a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Michigan and a National Geographic explorer, has eyes only for the 36 monarchs he captured earlier in the day. He applies a dot of epoxy between the wings of the butterfly in his hand, then affixes a custom-designed sensor, a stack of computer chips powered by a miniature solar panel that together weigh less than 3 grains of rice. The soft flutter of wings is the only sound in the room. This monarch and its companions, Green and his collaborators expect, will carry the sensors to the mountains of central Mexico, 800 miles south. In a few weeks, the researchers will follow the monarchs to Mexico, where they will try to detect the signals emitted by the sensors' antennas. If they can recapture one or more of the butterflies, a big if, they will be able to access the light and temperature data collected by the sensors en route, allowing them to map each butterfly's path. Like other monarch research projects across North America, this one has been aided by volunteers eager to help the species. Green's colleagues, realizing that bicyclists travel at about the same speed as monarchs on the move, recruited cyclists to test the accuracy of the sensors by carrying them on multi-day rides. Green conducted laboratory experiments to confirm that the sensors don't interfere with flight. Now this novel technology is about to undergo its first real-world test. When he finishes attaching the sensors, Green sits back in an overstuffed leather chair, surveying the butterflies in the net cage before him. "This year we'll be happy if we pick up any kind of signal in Mexico," he says. "Collecting meaningful data might require several more seasons of trial and error," but Green is patient. Smiling, he resorts to scientific understatement. "It's a real opportunity to understand this particular system," he says. As the day cools, Green carries the cage of butterflies outside, picking his way downhill to the pecan grove, below the lodge. There, beside a creek, hundreds of migrating monarchs swirl through the lengthening light. Green extracts the sensor-carrying butterflies one by one, gingerly settling them on low-hanging branches like so many glass ornaments. Tomorrow morning, if all goes well, they will continue to venture south, taking their secrets with them. The system that so fascinates Green is one of the most epic and dangerous journeys on the planet. Though monarchs live throughout the world, in South America, the Caribbean, Australia, Europe, and elsewhere, North American monarchs are distinguished by their extraordinarily ambitious seasonal migrations. Each fall, monarchs in the northern United States and southern Canada fly south, the first relay team, along a 3,000-mile route known only to earlier generations. Those that survive gather in central Mexico, where they spend the winter in the same fir groves that sheltered their grandparents and great-grandparents the previous year. Despite decades of study, this annual ultramarathon and the shorter migration of the continent's western population along the Pacific coast is only partly understood and ever more perilous. Due to climate change and habitat loss, monarchs on both migration routes are increasingly beset by extreme weather and scarce nectar sources. At the same time, the milkweed plants that breeding monarchs need to host their eggs and feed their caterpillars remain in critically short supply, diminishing overall numbers. The prospects for North American monarchs are considered so dire that the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, has classified the two populations as vulnerable. They're now under consideration for protection by the U.S. Endangered Species Act. Those who have witnessed the population's decline hope their new status will lead to sustained multinational action. Karen Oberhauser, who has studied monarchs since the 1990s and recently retired as director of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum, says that since the monarch was first proposed for protection under law in 2014, the species has gained new support from government agencies and scientists. The level of federal engagement has just skyrocketed, and that's been so important, she notes. It brought a lot of really smart people into our circles. While the monarch is neither the largest nor the showiest butterfly in North America, no other insect and very few species of any kind so captivates us. Its travel connect people across generations, national borders, and even, it is said, the barrier between life and death. Some Mexican observers of the annual Day of the Dead regard migrating monarchs as souls of the wing. Emergency workers in Lower Manhattan during the days after September 11, 2001, saw the monarchs that sailed over Ground Zero as symbols of survival and rebirth. When we say that this butterfly is iconic, it is exactly that, says anthropologist Colombo Gonzalez Duarte of the New School for Social Research in New York City. It has a place now for North Americans as that insect that goes beyond borders that is capable of the impossible. Long before anyone understood how far North American monarchs travel, people celebrated their periodic appearances. Mexican poet and novelist Homero Rodriguez, whose memoir recalls his childhood in the central Mexican state of Michoacán during the 1940s and 50s, wrote that the autumn wind bore currents of butterflies. Rodriguez and his friends would trek to nearby mountain meadow to watch the butterflies alight in the firs, captivated by the spectacle. In the 1950s, Canadian zoologist Fred Urquhart and his wife Nora founded the Insect Migration Association, beginning a long tradition of public participation in monarch research. Over the next several decades, the association recruited some 3,000 volunteers to capture individual butterflies and mark each with a tiny label reading "Sent to Zoology University, Toronto, Canada." From the resulting data, the Urquharts surmised that monarchs spent the winter in Mexico but didn't know where. In 1973, when they placed a call for volunteers in a Mexico City newspaper, Kenneth Brugger, an American expatriate, responded. Brugger's wife Kathy, now Catalina Aguado Trail, had been paying close attention to monarchs and other butterflies since her childhood in Michoacán. She agreed to lend her language skills and knowledge of the region to the search for the monarch's wintering grounds. For 2 years, first on weekends and then full time, the couple crisscrossed the mountains of central Mexico by motorbike and on foot. On the afternoon of January 2, 1975, while climbing a volcanic peak called Cerro Pelon, Trail looked up into the firs and stopped short. The trunks and branches above her were covered with thousands of monarchs, so closely packed that their wings overlapped. When Brugger joined her, they both stood silently, awestruck. Trail and Brugger's elation soon turned to worry. The monarch's winter habitat in Mexico is almost entirely limited to 10 or so small patches of high elevation oyamel. That's a fir forest within an area of 217 square miles. In the 1970s, the local communities that hold communal rights to the forest depended on logging for a living, and the evergreen canopy that protects the monarchs from winter weather was shrinking fast. Crowds of curious visitors could further disrupt the habitat. As word got out, tourists did travel to the mountains to gaze up at the monarchs, but the news also prompted action. The IUCN called on the Mexican government to protect the fir groves, as did the Mexican environmental group ProMonarca. Though the government established a national reserve that in October 1986 banned or limited logging in five of the known wintering grounds, the hoped-for economic benefits of tourism for local communities were spotty and logging continued. In 2000, after long and sometimes acrimonious debate among government officials, scientists, conservation advocates, and community representatives, the reserve was expanded threefold to encompass most of the monarch's known wintering habit. The Monarch Fund, which is administered by the Mexican government and supported by international conservation groups, began making modest but consistent payments to the residents who hold rights within the core zone of the reserve, partially compensating for lost timber income and successful protection efforts. Around the same time, a group of Mexican sustainable development advocates founded the organization Altener, which works with communities like the reserve on projects like reforestation and water conservation. Thanks to these and other initiatives, logging in the reserve began to decline, and by the early 2010s, annual forest loss had fallen from hundreds of acres to single digits, a major conservation success. Since 2019, forest loss has once again increased, this time because of drought-driven bark beetle outbreaks and the legal logging that is intended to control them. Part of the problem, says geographer Isabel Ramirez of the International Autonomous University of Mexico, is that the state forest management policies haven't caught up with the changing climate. Early on a December morning, I follow Andre Green and his team along a narrow trail into the Sierra Chicua Monarch Sanctuary in central Mexico. My first impression is that the tall, slender trees around us are covered with rusty foliage. When my eyes and brain catch up to reality, I realize that every fir in sight is draped with slumbering butterflies, wings folded to display their paler undersides. The layers of insects are heavy enough to bend even the sturdiest branches. The cool mountain air seems to vibrate, stirred by the countless wings twitching above our heads. As the struggle to protect the wintering grounds unfolded in the 1990s and early 2000s, scientists from Mexico to Canada were working to understand the monarch's astonishing annual journey. Longtime monarch researcher Lincoln Brower and his colleagues learned that while the monarchs that overwinter in Mexico travel north in the spring, they don't complete the trip. They instead lay eggs in northern Mexico and throughout the southern U.S. When those offspring mature, they continue to the northern U.S. and southern Canada, also laying eggs along the way. During the summer, two or three more generations emerge. The final generation, unlike its predecessors, doesn't immediately reproduce, but it is a state of suspended maturation called diapause. When the days begin to shorten and cool, these aging teenagers head south, returning to Mexico in a single generation. Since those Mexican-bound monarchs can't ask their great-grandparents for directions to the winter colonies, scientists reason that they must be able to navigate. Through a succession of studies, researchers learned that monarchs are equipped with two compasses, a primary system that uses the sun, and a backup system that uses the Earth's magnetic field. In a study published in 2009, biologist Christine Merlin and her collaborators found that monarchs use circadian clocks located in their antenna to correct their sun compass readings for the planet's daily rotation. While this elaborate system keeps monarchs headed in the right direction, it doesn't fully explain their ability to home in on the same circumscribed wintering grounds year after year. In the Sierra Chicua Sanctuary, the sun climbs higher above the horizon and the rustling in the trees increases. Monarchs open their wings to bask, warming their muscles in preparation for flight, and the whole forest seems to brighten. On the steep slope above the trail, one of the team's radio receivers stands ready to detect a sensor-carrying butterfly, just in case one has not only reached Mexico but chosen this stand of firs as a winter home. A few monarchs began flitting from tree to tree and soon were surrounded by a muffled cacophony of millions of moving wings, a torrent that glows above around and around us. Some of the monarchs stream out of the grove while others weave through the trees, radiant in the filtered sunlight, occasionally dipping low enough to skim our faces and hands. All the while, though, the receiver remains silent. Since returning to their laboratories at the Universities of Michigan, Delaware, and Pittsburgh, Green and his colleagues have improved the energy efficiency of the sensors, ensuring that the solar panels will be able to harvest enough sunlight in the shady forest reserves. In October 2023, they attached 175 sensors to butterflies in Texas, boosting the chances of capturing a signal they climb into the Sierra Chinqua this winter. It's just a marvelous, marvelous organism, and understanding how it's able to do what it can allows us to understand the biological world a little better, says Green. So long as they're performing the behavior, I'd be interested in overcoming the obstacles to understand it. Why protect migration, North American monarchs? Well, the answers I found as I followed their journey are almost as varied as the monarch allies themselves. Some, like Green, are drawn to the butterfly's mysteries. Others admire its beauty and tenacity. Many monarch volunteers from international friendships that they come to value almost as much as the butterflies. For Jane Breckenridge, co-founder of the Tribal Alliance for Pollinators, restoring monarch habitat as a part of a broader endeavor to support species of all kinds, including humans. Monarchs are special and magical, and I love them, she says, but the problem they face are problems faced by all our native pollinators and all of other native critters. A citizen of the Muscogee Nation in the northeastern Oklahoma, Breckenridge grew up in nearby Tulsa, then spent 2 decades in Minnesota before returning to live in her grandmother's land in 2004. There, she and her husband David opened a commercial butterfly farm, cultivating an array of species for sale to zoos and museums. She started the program called Natives Raising Natives, which recruits tribal members to rear butterflies and the native plants they need at home for extra income. In 2014, Breckenridge asked University of Kansas professor Chip Taylor for help in restoring a monarch migration corridor on the tribal lands in Oklahoma. Taylor, the founder of the volunteer monarch tracking organization Monarch Watch, was enthusiastic. He knew monarchs badly needed more habitat in Oklahoma, but he suspected it would not be easy. Patches of native prairie are so rare that locally adapted seed supplies can only be acquired through labor-intensive collection. 10 years later, the Tribal Alliance for Pollinators is the largest producer of native plants and seeds in Oklahoma, and it works with tribes throughout the Great Plains and beyond. Seeds from 230 native prairie species are available free to all tribal members, and each year the small staff distributes tens of thousands of young plants to individuals and institutions. Tribes throughout Oklahoma have documented breeding monarchs making heavy use of the milkweeds in their pollinator gardens, which also host native bees, small mammals, and other species. The plants benefit humans, too, for some have ceremonial significance or medicinal uses, and all are appreciated for their colorful variety. The Muscogee Nation is home to two distinct indigenous languages, Muscogee and Yuchi, and the latter is spoken by a few dozen people. That number, however, is growing. At the local immersion school, preschoolers and elementary students greet the day in Yuchi, then tend to the school's garden of native plants. During the winter of 2019, inspired in part by the work of the Tribal Alliance for Pollinators, the school's staff and instructors crowded into a van and drove to central Mexico, where they trekked into one of the sanctuaries to see the butterflies that would before long be flying toward Muscogee Nation. For school co-founder Haley Turninghart, who learned Yuchi as a child and now speaks it with her young children, the connection between her work and the monarch's migration is obvious. We see the language as essential for our survival, and we know that butterflies are struggling for their survival, she says. We recognize that they're fighting their habitat and that they're helping to bring it back. Rather, they're fighting for their habitat, I should say, and that we're helping to bring it back. The sight of the monarchs assembled in Mexico, she remembers, was both awe-inspiring and heart-wrenching. We knew we might not see it again the same way. We know how quickly things can change. Nowhere in the enormous challenge of bringing back monarch habitat more obvious than in Iowa. The state's fertile soil grows more than 2 billion bushels of corn each year, almost all of which is used for livestock feed or ethanol production. And rural Iowa is dominated by field after field of corn and soybeans. In 1996, when Monsanto began introducing genetically modified crops that are resistant to the herbicide glyphosate, or Roundup, farms across the Midwest started using glyphosate for weed control, killing milkweed and other benign natives in the process. Today, native plants find refuge on the grounds of the Tallgrass Prairie Center at the University of Northern Iowa, where staff members tend neat rows of milkweed, spiderwort, and other species. The seeds for these plantings are collected in the state's vanishingly small remnants of native prairie, several located in the 19th century cemeteries that were among the few places off limits to settler plows. Every year, commercial seed, some produced from this genetically diverse stock, is distributed to the state's county road departments, which plant it on Iowa's road margins. The program, started more than 30 years ago as an attempt to sustainably manage roadside vegetation, is now one of the most extensive habitat restoration efforts in the state. Iowa transportation officials estimate that about a quarter of the state's roadsides are planted with native grasses and wildflowers, and the plants frequently host monarchs and other insects. Throughout rural Iowa, county roadside managers serve as informal ambassadors for the value of native prairie, explaining that what may look like a stand of weeds in need of mowing is a low-maintenance, ecologically rich echo of prairie's past. But Iowa's roadsides cover only a tiny part of the state, and experts say that in order to reproduce at rates that will stave off extinction, North American monarchs require at least twice the amount of milkweed currently available in the entire Midwest, as well as reliable supplies of other nectar-producing natives along their migratory routes. We need much more than 1% of the land area to counteract all that's been lost, says Laura Jackson, the director of Tallgrass Prairie Center. The state has little public land. State-managed roadsides make up less than a fifth of it. So Jackson and the rest of the center staff also work on private land habitat restoration through the Federal Conservation Reserve Program, which contracts farmland for conservation purposes. In 2018, they began collaborating on a major restoration project with Kathy Irvine, a retired special education teacher in northeastern Iowa who has donated almost 300 acres of her family's corn and bean fields to the center as a tribute to her late husband, David. On a June afternoon, a pair of monarchs flits across 80 acres already thick with milkweed, wild indigo, purple coneflower, and other native flowers and grasses. None of this will be planted again except as prairie, she says with satisfaction. If Iowa embodies the difficulty of prairie restoration, the Irvine Prairie illustrates its possibilities. Getting the right combination of viable native seeds into hospitable ground is no small feat, and restoration practitioners are well acquainted with failure. Humility is big around here, says Jackson. Plantings also require periodic burnings or mowing to keep out woody species. Once prairie plants take root, however, valuable habitat can open fast or happen fast. Irvine and Jackson look forward to the day when seeds from these native species begin to sprout on nearby roadsides, setting forth into the landscape their ancestors called home. Each spring, the overwintering generation of monarchs in Mexico performs a final spectacular feat, flying hundreds of miles north to lay their eggs. During an April visit to the Muskogee Nation, I watch a single monarch, identifiable as a female by her thick black wing veins, travel low over a sun-baked putting green, the ragged edges of their wings a testament to her endurance. If she hasn't finished laying her eggs, several hundred in total, typically deposited by one of the undersides of the milkweed leaves, she soon will, for her life is nearly at an end. Her progeny and theirs will complete the trip, going north as far as southern Canada. Now, this defunct golf course, acquired by the Muskogee Nation from a private owner, doesn't look much like a butterfly habitat, but the monarch is snacking on nectar from a cluster of native plants, and more flowers will bloom soon. Colin Spriggs, a conservation botanist with the Tribal Alliance for Pollinators, parks his blue hatchback on the turf and unloads fragrant trays of lemon lemon bee balm and mountain mint seedlings. Leading the small crew of planters in Muskegee Nation, wildlife technician Brooklyn Bartling, whose left bicep is tattooed with images of a blackberry, a bee, and a ladybug. Bartling excitedly describes the nation's plan to turn the course into a nature reserve, as well as her work helping to remove invasive plants from the grounds and establish native wildflowers. "I'm taking pictures of butterflies, caterpillars, bugs, everything I see here," she says. "I want to get that information to the public to put the why behind what we are doing." She and Sprigg stand over a compass plant, a native perennial they've been keeping an eye on since planting last year. Now, though it was just two leaves, Sprigg says its taproot may already extend several feet into the subsoil, affording the plant access to water even during the current drought. Bartling grins at the news and looks up to survey the fairway. "There's a lot of potential here," she says. "A lot of potential." Well, there's a brief sidebar to this main article, and it's titled "Restoring Monarch's Habitat 1 Yard at a Time." And again, we find this in the January 2024 issue of National Geographic. In the United States, where lawns and other residential landscapes cover nearly 140 million acres, tens of thousands of people are turning their outdoor spaces into a habitat for monarchs and other species. This is a grassroots approach, says author and entomologist Doug Tellamy, co-founder of the organization Homegrown National Park. "You don't need anyone's permission to do it, and you get to enjoy the results," he says. "To join the movement," says Tellamy, "focus on supplying monarchs with their two basic needs, a place to breed and fuel for their long migration in the fall." And then there's some bullet points to go with the article. The first one, milkweed, which offers essential breeding habitat, is easy to grow in beds and container gardens. Next bullet point, in general, select the milkweed species best suited to your climate, but note that researchers advise against planting tropical milkweed, especially in warm climates, because its year-round flowers may delay or interrupt migration. And then the final bullet, to provide monarchs with calories for their journey, choose native perennials that will produce blooms and nectar at different times throughout the growing season. Jenny and Bill Nelson, who have transformed their quarter-acre Wisconsin yard into a homegrown Perry, advise backyard restorationists to start slowly. 30 years ago, they established a single 8-foot square bed of native plants. Year by year, they replaced more lawn and evergreen hedges with a cornucopia of native species. On a summer afternoon, Jenny watched a monarch circle the flaming orange blossoms of a butterfly weed. She says, "The butterflies have always been here. I just didn't know it." What an exciting trip that was, just to find out how these folks are doing things. Some great pictures, by the way, of some of these researchers. One is a 2-page spread. They're out and with all these native plants and the different flowers needed to help the pollinators. And this one says, Wendy Caldwell, executive director of Monarch Joint Venture, and Timothy Fredericks of Bayer Crop Science, flag milkweed near New Germany, Minnesota, as pilots Drew Smith and Christine Sanderson fly drones that survey milkweed abundance. So these drones, you can see them in the picture. That's how they cover these acres and acres of plantings in order to find out just how well they are maintaining this monarch project and keeping the population intact and hopefully growing. What a great trip that was. Well, thank you for listening to today's journey on Armchair Traveler. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.